Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC Legislative Studio in downtown Raleigh, it is Wednesday, December 19th, 2018. Most likely, barring something very surprising, the final podcast of 2018. And here for a trip down memory lane is a political columnist for the News and Observer, the author of several books of North Carolina politics and history, and a longtime observer of what is now hashtag NCPOL. Rob Christensen, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Thank you for being here. 45 years. It's before I was born. It's before Gerald Ford ever took office as the president. It's before David Thompson won a national title with NC State, just to make you feel old right off the top.
I'm already feeling old, so you no need to pile on.
Sorry. does it feel like it's been 45 years?
No, it doesn't. It feels like I can remember very vividly my first day at the NNO and just showing up. And so all these things, you'll find out as you get older that time passes more quickly. And so it doesn't feel like 45 years at all. And maybe it's because I always enjoy what I'm doing. And so I've been very lucky. Not many people go to work every day to follow politics and government and enjoy what they do. You know, a lot of people, you know, this is their hobby, politics. Well, I made a living out of following politics. So I feel very fortunate and you know, I worked in some factories and textile mills and stuff when I was in school and going through school, and this sure beats the heck out of that. So
when you say you remember your first day vividly, quick sidebar, I grew up outside of Boston, and Bob Ryan, the longtime columnist for the Boston Globe sports section, he covered the Celtics for a long time. His first day was in 1968, and I'm not remembering in my head, but it was either the day MLK was assassinated or the day RFK was assassinated. Why do you remember your first day so vividly? What happened?
Well, there was no major event, but it was just so exciting coming from the University of Tennessee to interview for your first job. It turned out to be for my last job.
Right.
So it's very Japanese to work for one company all your whole career. And I can remember approaching the News Observer, which was until recently has been on 215 South McDowell Street, and seeing a young woman who rushing across the street because she had a deadline. And it turned out, or later learned, she was Leslie Wayne and went on to a great career at New York Times. And, you know, I looked at that and said, you know, this is life for me. And there's, for some people, reporting is just is just something in your blood. You know, I read one time Russell Baker, who was a famous columnist for the New York Times. He said, you could tell somebody who really liked news is that if a fire engine comes by, you want to get up and leave the restaurant or whatever and go chase to see what's going on. Well, when the fire engine comes by, I've always wanted to go chase and see what's going on with the fire. And so even though I cover politics, that's, you know, I just always wanted to be in the center of action and get a front row seat to political history.
All right. So 45 years of North Carolina political history. I'm going to do my best to keep the question simple and stay out of your way, because I imagine there's some pretty good stories that we can hopefully get to here. And I'll bounce around a little bit, as I tend to do. Across these 4.5 decades, what has been the most constant? What hasn't changed? What has been just repetitive and cyclical, specific to North Carolina politics? And what have been one or two of the biggest changes you've observed?
Well, Let me start with some of the changes. Is that
sure? Go ahead.
I started out in politics. I was very fortunate in that it was the end of an old era. And so when I started covering politics, politics was practiced in ways that had been practiced for decades. You still had a few of the old county courthouse machines and county bosses. You had, I would campaign with candidates and we'd hit country stores, you know, where you go in there and get a Coke and a Nabs. Or some peanuts,
And when you say nabs, because I'm a fringe blender, we're talking about crackers.
Like crackers, peanut butter, right. And so there hardly are any more country stores, but certainly cans don't really campaign there anymore. And you had these big rallies and so forth in the tobacco warehouses, because in many places, particularly in eastern North Carolina, that was the biggest facility.
Right.
And I still remember the sweet smell of tobacco in there. So many, many rallies. And things like, you know, these cans don't do these anymore either, as they work the shift lines when the shift changes. So whether it was one of the big cigarette manufacturers in Durham or one of the big textile mills in Kannapolis, like Cannon Mills, I remember standing out there with candidates as they work the shift. And of course, some people would come up and shake the candidate's hands, other than would not give you a straight look in the eye and just sneak by because they didn't like you. But so I got to see politics as it was once practiced. And so that gave me insight to the way it had the past decades. But then because I've been doing this for so long, I saw the transformation to politics of media politics, where the county courthouse bosses are really replaced by the media consultant, and where campaigning, particularly for statewide campaigning, has become much more TV-driven and much more through political commercials. It also made it more expensive. So it used to be statewide campaigns cost $1 million for running for governor, senator. Now they're up to $100 million for some of these big races. And so then the TV has really has led to the incredible cost. I've seen other changes. So, you know, I was in the last era, really, of Democratic hegemony. But it was becoming a two-party state, and it certainly has become more of a two-party state. And in fact, we've seen Republicans rise in insurgence. And so, but it was a much more of a Democratic town. It was Democrats controlled the legislature. They usually covered the governorship. Most of the lobbyists were Democrats. Most, you know, the special interest groups were Democrats. But both parties really have changed, too, over the years. So,
because those Democrats were pro-business.
So there was a mixture.
Okay.
So the Democratic Party was a much broader party, and as were the Republicans. The Democrats, you had both conservative Democrats and moderate Democrats and liberal Democrats and pro-business Democrats and environmental Democrats. And so you had a very, very broad party. What we've seen over the last number of years is that a lot of the conservatives and some of the moderates have gone to the Republican Party. And so the Democratic Party was a very broad party. A lot of the fights were right within the Democratic Party. But the Republican Party, too, was also broader. So you had a lot of very ideological conservatives. But you also had a lot of Republican moderates, particularly from the mountains and from the foothills. And so the Republican Party was broad, much broader than it is today. So what we've seen are the two parties have become, in some ways, more ideologically coherent. The Democrats are much more liberal than they used to be. The Republican Party is much more conservative. And that's part of the polarization we've seen. We also saw, when I started covering here, there was only like one or two black legislators. And so they were only now getting back into the legislature after having been essentially barred from the legislature for two-thirds of the 20th century. And so the party was beginning to broaden, the politics was beginning to broaden in terms of African-Americans. Also women, you know, this really was a good old boy place and with all that entails, including, a lot of, skirt chasing and all that sort of thing. It was a lot of guys came to the legislature to do some drinking and get away from their wives. and it's changed, of course, for the better. And so now it's not a perfect gender balance, but it's a much better balance than it was. And women have made the place a little more, less of a guy's club and good old boys club.
Quick follow-up is, as the new legislature is seated on January 9th of 2019, it's going to be about 27% of the legislators here, of the 170, will be women. And 40 members of the 40 of the 170 members will be lawmakers of color. So to your point, I mean, it certainly has changed from, you know, the 50s and 60s and even early 70s. I think you started roughly the same time Mickey Mishaw was first elected.
That's right.
To this body. And he was the third African-American elected in the 20th century, give or take a couple.
Something like that. I remember George Johnson of Fayetteville and Henry Fry was the first of Greensboro. And
that's
so,
right.
And Henry Fry was elected, I believe, in 1968. That was the breakthrough year.
So you just mentioned a whole lot of changes. What has been a constant in politics during your time?
Well, so there are certain things that that no matter who is in control, you see. So this place, this being the legislative building in Jones Street, is a whirl unto itself. It's very isolated.
Here, here.
It's not the real world. Lawmakers who are unknown across the state are often powerful people here in on Jones Street. Maybe not a couple blocks from here, but here. And so, you know, the reporters hang on their words, and the lobbyists come and kiss their ring and make sure they're. They have plenty of money at campaign time and so forth. And so we have all these people who are these legislative mandarins, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, who live in this very isolated environment where they're powerful. But if you walk a couple blocks from here down to Fayetteville Street, no one knows who they are. So it's this insular world still exists. The business community has always been the most powerful, and that hasn't changed. It doesn't change. Same when Democrats were in control. Same with Republicans, because they have the financial ability to hire the top lobbyists and make sure that they're here all the time and watch all the legislation. But also, it's also a reflection of the fact of the longer history of North Carolina politics. Started out the 20th century as a very poor state and one of the poorest in the country. And so a lot of the state's history for the last 100 or so years has been how does a poor rural state industrialize? And so industry is not only powerful, but it's also important. It doesn't matter whether Democrats are in control or Republicans control, whether you're talking about a textile mill or you're talking about, you know, trying to get Apple or one of these big high-tech firms to come in here. There's always been this chase of industry to provide jobs to help try to bring North Carolina into the economic national mainstream. And so that's been a constant. On the flip side, labor has been very ineffective here because it's one of the least unionized states in the country. And a lot of legislatures, you know, labor is the counterbalance
right.
to the big business, not here so much. I mean, they've been active and they try, but they just never had any
clout. It's a non-entity.
Yeah.
Or a lesser entity.
Lesser entity, yeah.
Rob Christensen is here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. We're taking a little jaunt down memory lane, North Carolina political and historical memory lane. Rob is retiring from the News and Observer. He's going to continue to write. And will you continue to teach? Do you teach?
I do not
you
teach.
You do not teach.
No,
okay.
No.
I stand corrected. But you will continue to write. Your last column appeared in the NNO in recent days. I'm just going to offer the first paragraph because we've touched on some of these things, but I want to prompt you with something we haven't gotten to yet. I have stumped with candidates in country stores, church campgrounds, and in sweet-smelling tobacco warehouses. I have climbed in and out of suspiciously small campaign airplanes in questionable weather. I have watched shift changes at cigarette factories in Durham and textile mills in Kannapolis. I have enjoyed the joyous music in African-American churches. Tell me about one of these plane rides. Who were you with? Where did you go? What was the weather? I mean, I feel like that you were – there's a story within that sentence.
Well, so the way reporters covered political campaigns, particularly statewide campaigns like for governor and for U.S. Senate, is somewhat different today than in the past. I'm not saying it was better in the past, but it's different. And so we covered these big campaigns in the earlier period much more like presidential races, and that we were with the candidates quite a bit, and we'd spend time with them as they hip-hopped across the state, often in this very small planes, and today you don't find generally lot of reporters going around. There's less demand for this kind of what the candidate X said yesterday, last night at a big rally in Hickory, that sort of thing. And so we have a different kind of coverage. And also the press corps is much more diminished, too. But that's another subject. So and so the candidates often had these very small planes, and which were scary in part because, you know, they often had a rally at the other end. And so there was a lot of pressure for them to take off no matter what the weather. And I don't mind flying in big planes, but I don't like little planes. And I especially don't like little planes in bad weather.
How little? Are we talking six-seaters?
Eight-seaters, well, Cessnas? Different ones. But okay. Yeah, but that's basically what we're talking about. And so I remember one year where I was doing a lot of flying with candidates, there were two crashes that year in North Carolina.
Wow.
So we had a gubernatorial candidate, Locke Faircloth's plane went down.
Mm-hmm.
And went down in the water on a lake, and everybody got out safely. And then we had another gubernatorial candidate's plane with Rufus Edmonstead, who was a gubernatorial candidate, and I don't think he was in a plane, but his whole staff was in a plane, and his chief strategist, a guy named Charlie Smith, died of a heart attack during the crash. He wasn't killed by the impact
crash itself,
but it was such a
effects of the crash.
Yes, yeah. And so and some people think he may have lost the gubernatorial campaign because his lead strategist died right in the middle of it. So when you have planes going that's one campaign, two planes going down, and sometimes these cancer might have like 10 news conferences across the state.
In a day. Wow.
So maybe an exaggeration, but you get the picture. And so they're up and down, up and down, up and down. So they'll fly out of Raleigh, and then they land in Goldsboro, and then they're down in Kinston, and they're over Elizabeth City, and then they're down to Wilmington, and then they're, you know, it's just one small airport after another. So they can get coverage on the local TV station, local newspapers. And so, I mean, particularly in bad weather, you know, it's up and down, up and down, up and down, and your stomach is like, is pretty bad, and you turn several colors of green. And I can remember one case I did actually throw up, and the candidate thought, it was John Ingram, who was I think a Senate candidate. He just thought that was hilarious that I threw up. So, but campaigning is really interesting. Is that it was much more. You talk about Donald Trump today and his bashing of the news media, but that's always been going on. And so I can remember, for example, Jimmy Green was a lieutenant governor. This is when lieutenant governors had a lot more power in North Carolina. They had the power, say, of a Phil Berger today.
They were the head of the Senate.
They were the head of the Senate. They appointed all the committees and so forth. So they were real powerhouses. But Jimmy Green was this crusty conservative Eastern North Carolina tobacconist, tobacco grower, and I think warehouseman as well. And he, we'd been giving him a hard time. He had various investigations involving him and so forth by not just us, but by law enforcement officials. So he was campaigning for governor. And so we'd go around these country stores, and he just liked to make me sweat. So he would go in these stores with these kind of hard-looking farmers, and he'd just be sitting around, you know, and he says, he'd give his little talk, and he says, you see that fella sitting over there, pointing at me? And he says, that's Rob Christensen. He's with the News and Observer. He says, and that's the fella that's been giving me all that trouble back in Raleigh. And then the men would turn around and give you a hard stare and so forth. And it was just like a little intimidation tactic. Then he'd get back in the car and be friendly enough, and then we'd go to the next stop, and then he'd do it again. He'd just do it over. It was like pulling wings off of a fly or something. It was his form of amusement.
So the tool of intimidation has been there. But were you ever approached? Did you ever physically feel like you were in danger? I mean, was this just – this was a quick stumping tool of his, or did it ever escalate or elevate?
Well, it didn't really escalate. I mean, that was just his intimidation game.
Okay.
But he tried to intimidate lots of people, and that was his style. But Jesse Helms was another one that did that when he was a U.S. senator. And so he would get going. I remember, for example, one time in we were down in, I think it was 1990 campaign in the United States Senate, and running against Harvey Gantt. And we were down at a big rally in Goldsboro at a tobacco warehouse where you can sit hundreds of people. And he started listing why the liberal news media was destroying America. And he had a shopping list. You know, they were destroying America because of this and that and so forth. And at the end of his litany of what, the ways the liberal news media was destroying America, he'd point right at me and says, as represented by Rob Christensen, who's sitting right there. And I remember on that particular occasion, I had a big-time New York Magazine writer who was in tow, and he just sort of jumped out of his seat when he did that, and he began looking around at the crowd, make sure nobody was coming with pitchforks. And he says, that'd be scary if this crowd wasn't so damn old.
Give me a time that you were scared covering politics during your 45 years. You're telling us a little bit about Jimmy Green and Jesse Helms here. It doesn't sound like you personally were scared in those instances, but was there a time, perhaps something that was less public and outward, did a lawmaker or a staff member ever lean on you or really threaten you?
Well, so, first of all, you have to sort of understand that this came with the territory, so you sort of got used to it. And I don't think I was ever scared that I thought I was going to get beat up or anything. Although I have another story about another reporter who did, but for example, I was in 1984. I was thrown out of the state Republican convention by resolution, and it was by the Helms forces. And whereas the News Observer has never been fair to our great Senator Jesse Helms, blah blah blah, and so after they passed the resolution, people were yelling and screaming, and they were standing on their chairs and yelling, "Throw the bastard out!" And I had a sergeant of arms, a bunch of big fellows came and led me through this mob, essentially. Well, not a mob, it was a crowd. And as I was being let out, the presiding officer, who was this fundamentalist minister from Elizabeth City named Barry McCarty, as I was being let out, he tunes into the crowd, "The cancer has been surgically removed." So.
Wow. Wow.
So, but
did you, just a quick follow-up on that. I mean, I'm just thinking about my role as a reporter. Did you have to go back in there 20 minutes later or an hour later to talk to anybody or ask questions? Did you get in your car and drive home? I mean, that's a big dramatic moment, but similar to Jimmy Green pointing at you in the country store, was that the end of it?
Well, I mean, he never did like me, and he made my life uncomfortable, and he once got one of my colleagues thrown out of his apartment because he was a neighbor.
Senator Helms, we're talking about.
No, this is actually Jimmy Green.
Oh, sorry, back to
Jimmy Green. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
And so I got one of my colleagues he was a neighbor of, and the colleague was renting an apartment in West Raleigh, and Jimmy Green was a neighbor, and one thing, I don't think he liked a reporter living nearby. And so, for various reasons. And so he got the landlord to toss him out. But you have to put this in perspective. You know, there's a lot of things, dangerous things reporters do, but they're mainly like in places like Africa and the Middle East and so forth, mm-hmm. where you have, revolutions going on or civil wars. And I don't ever want to leave the impression that it was anything like that. We honored recently a guy named Gene Roberts. Gene Roberts covered politics for us, News Observer, and then went on to an illustrious career. He was editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer for a couple decades, and where they won 20-some Pulitzers or something. And then he was managing editor of the New York Times for a while. He's from near Goldsboro, a little town near Goldsboro. But anyway, he was being honored, and we had a little lunch for him in Raleigh. But anyway, when he was covering 1960 governor's race. And he had the same sort of things that we had Helms involved in and Trump involved in. There was a lot of intimidation of reporters. And so this has gone on for a long time. And the newspaper was editorially very supportive of Terry Sanford, who was kind of this progressive Democrat who was running the Democratic primary. And he was running against a guy named I. Bobby Lake Sr., who was a lawyer, Harvard-trained lawyer, but he was the segregationist and very conservative. And so he was down in Lumberton. Gene Roberts was, and one of the press people for I. Beverly Lake, the segregationist, came up to Gene and said, He says, you know, our guy is going to go after you in a few minutes. I'm just giving you a heads up. And he did. So he started going after how News Observer hadn't treated him, had never been treated him fairly, blah, 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 as represented by Gene Roberts over there. And then he could see some men beginning to move toward him. So he quickly made an exit from the hall, wherever it was, down in Lumberton. And then as soon as he got out, he really got quick because he saw men starting to come after him. And the reporter for the local, or the editor of the local paper, or the Robesonian, motioned for him to come into, they had a storefront newspaper office there. They get into the storefront newspaper office. They pulled the blinds, turned out the lights, and the mob, who was now this time going after him, passed him by. And then they got on the phone, and very quietly, the local editor called the I can't remember if it was the police department or the sheriff's department, and said, we have our dead-end reporter here who may not get out of this thing alive. And so Gene got a...
Whose side was the sheriff on, right?
No, it was a good thing. And he had the help of the local editor, yeah, who had very good relationships with local law enforcement. And so he got a police escort. And so Gene was driving a little MG, and he had two big squad cars, one in front and one behind him, and take him to the county line to get into Fayetteville. So that's how he got out of covering that rally. So this sort of thing with Donald Trump has been going on for a very long time.
You've written thousands of articles, I think was one of the notes that you had in your final column. It's got to be thousands of articles, right?
Across the board? Yeah, more than 10,000.
Okay, more than 10,000 articles. Tell me about a story or a profile. Tell me about something you didn't get to, either because you weren't able to do it or tell the story, or perhaps it was a news event that you didn't get to cover. But what's a story that your byline never appeared on?
Well, so this doesn't quite answer your question, but my biggest regret, or the biggest story I missed, involved John Edwards, who was when he was running for president.
Mm-hmm. In 04?
In 08. In 08.
Okay.
And so... we got beat, me in particular, because I was the lead reporter covering it. We got beat by the National Enquirer, and they broke the story about him having a girlfriend, Rhea Hunter, and she was pregnant, and all this was hidden and had hush money and that whole affair, and so you know, I didn't know quite what was going on. I knew there were some problems there, but the Enquirer was able to get it in part because they were involved in checkbook journalism. So they were paying out, like, according to one of the people there at the paper, they were paying out like $50,000 for information and so forth, which we never do. You know, local press never involves in checkbook journalism, and they were very good at they being the National Enquirer, very good at you might call tabloid kind of journalism. So, you know, I think they rented an apartment near where the girlfriend was, mm-hmm, so they got photographers staking her out so they could get pictures of her and when she was pregnant and so forth, and devoted, you know, weeks and weeks and renting apartment and paying money to witnesses and so...
A wide array of resources.
Yeah, they had a wide array of resources, yeah. And so we got beat, and that obviously was an embarrassment because we were the hometown paper. That was a story. If you talk about stories amiss, that was the biggie.
Were you aware? Had you been tipped off to the affair? Were you working on it?
No, okay, no. Okay. So I mean, we knew that there were marital problems, mm-hmm, and that Elizabeth Edwards was not showing up on the campaign trail, mm-hmm, and that there were, you know, hints that things were really, really bad, but nothing. But I didn't have the specific tip that he had gotten this former campaign consultant or aide or whatever she was pregnant and having the baby. So I didn't know the specifics of that. So I wasn't like I was about to break that story and the National Enquirer came in.
I covered the Edwards trial in 2012, the campaign finance, the alleged federal campaign finance violations, as I believe it was Bunny Mellon, if the name is coming back, who made the payments to Rhea Hunter to keep her out of the campaign. Mm-hmm. Certainly some similarities to what we've seen with our current president.
That's right. A lot of people making those parallels.
Sure. Yeah. I do remember, I believe it was June 1st of 2012, when the jury came back not guilty on one count and couldn't come to an agreement on another count, maybe.
Right.
But where I'm going with this, I mean, I'm trying to set up some of the facts, and I'm not remembering them all that precisely, but I remember him standing on the courthouse and saying, "I don't think God's done with me yet." What do you think we're going to see out of John Edwards? If, and this is a throwaway question, but if he, you know, has another 10, 15, 20 years of health, could we ever see him run for public office again? What does he do the rest of his days?
Well, he has gone back to practicing law, right. and he's practicing law in Raleigh, and he lives in Chapel Hill. I think the answer is I think it's highly unlikely that he'll ever go back into elected politics. And he was so discredited, and it was such a big scandal that is, you can recover from some things, but you know, I think there are some things you cannot recover from. But it is interesting the parallels with the president, because you know the arguments that they made, I believe, the allegations were that it was a violation of campaign finance laws when they were taking this money to essentially hush money and so forth for his girlfriend, and the Edwards team's legal argument was that this is not a campaign finance, this was to keep all this from his wife Elizabeth,
right.
And so, and that similar argument is being made now by people close to President Trump that this wasn't the payments made to the stripper and so forth were they were not campaign it's not a campaign violation,
right.
These were
it's
efforts to
protection
keep things
of
quiet.
Family,
yes,
right,
yes.
Right. So this is the argument why all candidates have to have a spouse, right? You have to have somebody to blame.
That's right.
The campaign contributions on. Rob Christensen is on Twitter at Old Paul Hack, OldPolHack. You can find him on Twitter there. We're talking about his time covering politics here in North Carolina. One of the books that you've written, a book that I will admit to you I have not read cover to cover, but I have read sections of it and chapters of it, and I have reread some of the sections and chapters of it, is titled, and I don't have it in front of me, Paradox of North Carolina Politics.
Paradoxatorial Politics.
Paradox of Tar Heel Politics. Mm-hmm. I apologize. Thank you. Paradox of Tar Heel Politics talks about many of the themes, many of the things that we have touched on a little bit today. But in terms of the paradoxical aspect, in your time, has the paradox been at its greatest at any point?
No, I think it's been fairly...
It's a common thread.
Yeah, it's been continuous. And so people have a hard time figuring out, what is North Carolina politically? Because, it elects Jesse Helms, it elects John Edwards, it elects Terry Sanford, right. And, it's all over the map. And of course, the answer is, in my opinion, is that it is a swing state. It is very closely divided. Either Democrat or Republican can win. It has some of the closest margins of any state in the country. So it's not just an opinion. You can actually
right.
The numbers actually bear that out. There's things that people will think of as well. It's not a progressive state. It voted for. Amendment 1 again, a constitutional amendment against gay
same-sex marriage.
Same-sex marriage, that sort of thing. But so the thing you have to sort of understand is that it has progressive impulses. And so we've seen that in any number of things, like one of the great university systems, one of the best community college systems. And it's been very, very pioneering in the arts in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. and things like Research Triangle Park and the Banking Center and so forth. And so that's all true in some respects, particularly economic development and the arts, which are often seen as helping economic development, bringing in industry, bringing in business corporations, if you can provide a good cultural environment. But at the same time, it's very socially conservative, and it's very socially conservative because this state has never been dominated by big cities. So there's no Atlanta here like we have in Georgia or in so many other states where right. you're dominated by one big city. Charlotte's now pretty big, but it's only recently got pretty big. And so this is a state that's culturally been dominated by rural areas and by small towns. The Mayberry TV show was fiction, but it had some truth to it. I mean, that was North Carolina. And so it has always been, at the same time, it's done some pretty progressive things. Other times it's been you know, it's not been great on women's rights. It voted against the Equal Rights Amendment. It voted against women's suffrage amendment. It's, you know, voted against the lottery. It was one of the last states where you could buy an alcoholic drink in a restaurant. So it's also true for some issues that touch on gay rights or transgender rights, too. It's just across the board. So people have a hard time kind of sorting through that. So how can it be, is this a progressive state or is this a conservative state? And the answer is actually neither.
I could probably keep you in that chair and ask you questions for a couple of hours, but being respectful of your time, I'm going to try to just fire through a couple of ones quickly, which is something we do on the podcast here with regularity. And we'll end with this. But a favorite lawmaker to talk off the record with?
Well, Mark Bassnight, who was the leading Democratic
head of the Senate for at least a decade,
very powerful guy, and he was a really good guy to talk to.
One of your favorite places in the state, a place that you suspect very few listeners have been to.
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you one story is that I was covering an elections board, and the elections board was going through the records, and they found out there was this one little town in I don't think it was New Hanover County. It was in that area anyway.
Pender, Onslow, somewhere in that.
Yeah, that area, right. Southeastern part of the state. And they had not held – they had a town council and a mayor, but they had not held an election since, for 30 years.
What do you mean? Like, the mayor had just been on a 30-year term?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, well, I said, that's a story.
Yeah, it's a story.
So I went down there, and I called up town hall. They had a little town hall, and so I went down there and see what the story was. And so it was a really tiny little community. I mean it was not. They didn't have a stoplight. They didn't have a stop sign. It was just a really small place. But almost the whole town turned out to greet me. It wasn't much of a town. I understand.
Are we talking a few dozen people?
Yeah, a few dozen people. Okay. Yeah. And so they all. So when I wanted to go interview the mayor, about almost everybody, because the big city reporter was coming down to do a story about this, and. The most famous thing they're known for was they had a cemetery. David Brinkley, the famous national broadcaster's father, was from that town.
Okay.
And so they kept up the grave of David Brinkley's father. And so, you know, and they, you know, things that, you know, was a, they didn't have much of a budget, wasn't much of a town, but things were going pretty well. And so they didn't see really a need for an election, and so they just sort of were humming along. I mean, it was sort of like it wasn't like any competition. It was like who was going to volunteer to be mayor, right? And so, it was great. The whole town turned out.
Right. What was the name of this town?
I'm trying to remember the name. That's why I didn't come prepared.
You had no idea I was going to give you that question.
Yeah, I cannot remember the name. It'll come to me on the car
on the car ride home, right back to your house. So I've just pulled up David Brinkley's Wikipedia page, which is where. You know, we all go, or quickly our first step we go to, and it just says Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, so he grew up there, but his father grew up in this little town not too far from Wilmington.
Huh. All right, you'll have to let me know what you think of it. Last one for me. 2019, it's going to be a little bit different around here in this building. There are a dozen Republican incumbents who lost, some powerful ones as we think about Nelson Dollar, who's a lead budget writer in the House. Tamara Baringer of Wake County, who I think has been one of the few moderate lawmakers in recent years.
The two people you mentioned are both my personal legislators.
I did not know
that.
Bill Brawley was you know, narrowly ousted from Mecklenburg County, leaving this opening on a big opening, the chairmanship on an appropriations committee. Mickey Mishaw is retiring. Longtime Democrat from Durham. Tommy Tucker's retiring from the Senate. I'm just naming names for no real purpose here. But the supermajorities are gone. We are barreling toward the 2020 election. And I know some listeners just rolled their eyes, but here we are. We're 13 months away from the first primary, the first presidential primary. Gridlock or consensus come 2019 at the North Carolina legislature? and why? What do you? And I'm sure we'll see some of both, but what do you think we're going to see more of?
I think you're right. We'll see some of both, but we didn't have gridlock before because the Republican legislature was in total control. And so you never had gridlock because they could ignore the governor. In fact, they not only ignored Democrat Roy Cooper, but they pretty much ignored Republican Pat McCrory,
right,
too.
Right.
And so, if you're running, this is a totally legislative, powerful area where they ran everything. And so there was not gridlock because Republicans could essentially, if they agree among themselves, they didn't have to worry about the Democrats. Now they have to worry about Democrats because they have to worry about whether they can sustain a veto. And not to say that they can't, but they have to do that. They have to get some moderate to conservative Democrats to agree with them. So now there's going to be much more negotiations. It's going to be a much tougher job for the Republicans. And the Republicans have to be hearing footsteps, too, because, it's the Democrats are clearly, after years of where the Republicans have ran things, Democrats have the momentum right now. And a big election coming up in 2020. And so, and I think that's why one reason some of the Republicans are putting some of their policy initiatives into constitutional amendments, because they at least worry that they may not be in control forever. They might be, but we don't know. But it's no longer a sure thing. Things are now drifting back towards Democrats. And obviously, how far it goes depends on, the presidential race, which, because national politics spills over into state politics, and then if the Democrats get control in 2000, or at least control one house, I mean in 2020, yes, I'm totally out of it. then you have redistricting, and that's the key because, if this is about a 50-50 state, and it is about a 50-50 state, the Republicans have been able to maintain their large majorities legislature only because of their power of redistricting and gerrymandering. That's not to say that Republicans cannot, with just even fair districts, cannot win the Republican legislature. They can, but they can't. I don't think they can maintain these supersized majorities.
Rob Christensen, scribe of North Carolina politics, working on that first draft of history for 45 years. I hope that I'm still being a useful reporter 35 years down the road. So thank you for what you have done, your service to the constituents of North Carolina, and, of course, for chatting with me here for 45 minutes or so.
Been my pleasure.
Been great to have you along as well throughout the 2018 year. Thanks for clicking play on the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can, of course, subscribe to it at iTunes and Google Play and Stitcher. And if you enjoyed the conversation, feel free to share it on social media or with perhaps a family member or somebody in your circle of friends. Stay up to date on what is happening in your North Carolina legislature at our website, WUNC.org. Hope you have a Merry Christmas. For Rob Christensen, I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll likely talk to you again in 2019.
Santa Claus is coming to town.
Sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're away.
He knows if you've been bad or good.
So be good for goodness sake.
You better watch out. You better